we will continue with that that we have, maybe then take a short break. We will have all the submissions, and then we will ask the parliamentary legal advisor to do a short summary of where we are actually in terms of all the submissions, and then we'll decide on a way forward. Then this afternoon at 2 o'clock, just to remind members, we will also be continuing with the finalization of the critical infrastructure bill, very important protection bill, very important legislation. Members will remember that last time we received the legal opinion from the senior counsel, and also the new proposed clause 26. There's also other consequential amendments flowing from the senior counsel's advice, so that will be brought to us at 2 o'clock today, and we will then look at all those clauses in detail. So we will try and see that we can finalise that. Of course, we've got some apologies we received from members. Of course, that will influence us maybe going through this afternoon, but some of the members are on their way, so we will then see how we deal with that. In terms of the rest of the week, members, we will see what our progress is during the day, and we will advise later in terms of the program. But we still, I think, we are on track in terms of what we want to achieve. Members, then, I just want to quickly, again, for those who haven't been here last week, just to indicate where we are in the process and, what is our plan for today. Now, members will remember that in terms of process steps, number one, the committee develops and tables a memorandum for the purpose of obtaining the Assembly's permission. That was done. The Speaker must place the memorandum on the order paper, and the Assembly may give or refuse permission. Of course, that permission was given by the Assembly. Just to again highlight the fact that there was a specific permission given in terms of the amendment in terms of the bill. Then three, the committee prepares a draft bill to assist the committee. That was done in the committee. Then step four, the committee consults the JTM for advice on classification of the bill. That was done. Then five, notice of the intention to introduce is given in the Government Gazette together with a copy of the bill or an explanatory summary of the bill. That was done in five. Then six, if a copy of the bill is published in the Government Gazette, the notice must contain an invitation for interested persons and institutions to submit written representations on the bill. Interested persons must be given at least 3 weeks after publication to comment. Of course, the committee gave a 1 week extension, and then the relevant department organs of state must be given sufficient opportunity to make submissions to the committee. We received last week a joint presentation from the Civilian Secretary and IPED. There's today also additional submission by IPED that we received on Friday. Then, step seven, the committee must report to the House when it publishes the draft bill. That was done. And then step eight will actually kick in later today. Any written comments received must be considered. It's required that Parliament provides meaningful opportunity for public participation in the law-making process. And then nine, the committee may, in view of any comments received, make amendments to the draft bill before its introduction. I must say that, judging from all the input that we got last week and also on Friday, it's very high-quality input from all the institutions, and it's really contributing to the debate and on how to deal with independent institutions. Of course, the brief from this committee is very much narrowed. Then just to indicate that last week we received, apart from the joint briefing by IPED and CSB, we received the input from the Western Cape Department of Community Safety and Security, from the African Criminal Justice Reform, from the African Police Civilian Oversight Forum, and that was the presentations last week. In terms of our presentations for today, I just want to see, we will first start with the additional briefing by IPED. You're just welcome, sir. You can just also introduce your delegation, and then you're welcome to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honourable board members. Once again, my surname is Maoka. I'm the Director of Litigation Advisory Services in IP, and I'm with my Chief Director of Legal Services, Advocate Morasu. From IP, and from the CSPS also is Mr. Milton Duan. Thank you, Chair. May I then proceed? Thank you, Chair. Chair, correctly, as you have pointed out, that there was a joint presentation by IPID and CSPS last week. However, after the presentation, the IPID felt that it was very imperative that further submissions must be made, especially with the guidance of the accounting officer, based on the fact that they are the ones that initially took the matter to the Constitutional Court, and that there may be a better place to make certain submissions about the findings of the Constitutional Court and also the orders that were made. Chair, when the Constitutional Court delivered its judgment on the 6th of September, of importance to note is that when a judgment is delivered, one needs to consider the fact that, you know, courts will make or will pronounce on their reasons for arriving at a particular finding, and also subsequent thereto, the court will then make its orders. And as a result of that, there is nothing different with the procedure that was followed by the Constitutional Court in this particular matter. That is in the matter of McBride versus Minister of Police and another, another being Minister of Public Service Administration. The Minister of Public Administration, it is important also to remind the members that it abided by the decision of the court. But there were amicae curiae in this particular matter that were supporting the action by the executive director, which was the KSAC and also the Helen Suzman Foundation. Now, the importance of this particular two institutions then was to assist the two courts, that is beginning at the High Court, that is North Gauteng High Court, to assist the court in understanding the importance of the independence of oversight bodies such as the IPID. And both these particular NGOs or amicae curiae were admitted by the Constitutional Court and the North Gauteng High Court. And as a result, it is very important that one cannot ignore the submissions that were made, especially with regard to the independence of IPID. Chair, I'm not going to, in the presentation as we have done, I'm not going to go out of the committee bill's proposal that we follow the orders of the Constitutional Court in the amendment of Section 63A and Section 66. However, of importance when one has to understand is that in as far as Section 63A is concerned, it is really important that we understand or even understand the provisions thereof. Now, I know that we may know what the provisions of the sections then contain. However, it is important because, you know, in terms of our submissions at 4.1, especially regarding the concerns regarding the committee bill, we've tried to quote that particular section, and we also tried to emphasize, you know, those important wording of that particular section. Those wording, and maybe let me first read the whole section as it has been provided. I quote, "In the event of an appointment being confirmed, the successful candidate is appointed to the office of the executive director subject to the laws governing the public service with effect from a date agreed upon by such person and the minister." Now, we have bolded and underlined this particular words: the successful candidate is appointed to the office of the executive director subject to the laws governing the public service. Now, some of the findings that were made by the Constitutional Court was that the executive director may not be appointed in terms of the laws governing the public service. That is the finding. But what is important is that when the court made an order, the court said that to the extent that Section 63A purports to extend that the executive director may be suspended, removed or disciplined as a result of those laws governing the public service, then that provisions of Section 63A are invalid and unconstitutional. That's what the court has found. However, in the order, the court had declared Section 63A, and they even went to an extent of explaining how they arrived at those particular decisions. And in their submissions, they tried to show the importance of the executive director not being appointed in terms of Section 63A or not being appointed in terms of the provisions of the laws governing the public service. It was very important. And addition to that is that they found it very important that the minister doesn't play a role in the appointment of the executive director, in the remuneration and conditions of the executive director. To an extent that the Constitutional Court was found that the reason for excluding the minister is that the minister may use this particular opportunity by appointing or making those terms that are suitable to a candidate that the minister deemed fit or whom the minister thinks that that particular individual will dance to his tune. And for that particular purpose, the Constitutional Court then went to look at what canister, the principles that guided canister. And the Constitutional Court said, one needs to look at the DPCI. And the Constitutional Court made an observation to the effect that when it comes to the DPCI, the DPCI's constitutional its independence is not guaranteed in the Constitutional Court. Yet, when one looks at their independence is guaranteed. This guarantee of the DPCI is so guaranteed to an extent of starting with the appointment of the national head of the DPCI, the remuneration and terms and conditions of the DPCI, and the processes of appointing the DPCI are also provided for in the Act. Now, what the North Gauteng High Court found, and consequentially, what the Constitutional Court also confirmed that particular finding was that the independence of IPID, which is constitutionally guaranteed in terms of the provisions of Section 206(6) of the Constitution, it must be equally protected, if not greater than that. Now, what that means is that when the legislature has to decide on the processes of amending Section 63A, the legislature then cannot ignore that the appointment of the head of the DPCI, that is not constitutionally guaranteed in the Constitution, is entrenched in the legislation, that is the SAPS Act. Then you leave out the head of the executive director. What the court was saying is that Section 63A must be amended to the extent that even the appointment of the executive director must be provided for in the Act. And that is why in our submissions what we did was that we also contributed towards how to assist the legislature in amending that particular Section 63A. And we have attached in our submission also the proposals. Not that we are saying this is what the bill that must be amended, but looking at the time constraint that the committee has, we proposed in the event that the committee agrees or committee finds the submissions that the IPID is making are substantial in as far as a particular submissions are concerned, that then the legislature will have to look at those provisions and see whether that can assist in order to shorten the process and ensure that the appointment of the executive director is also included in as far as Section 63A is concerned. Now further, when they looked at the remuneration and terms and conditions of the relating to the constitutionally guaranteed independence of the IPID, what the Constitutional Court looked at also is that they are also provided for in the subsect, and they are clearly provided for. Now the question is, why would then such an institution such as the IPID, which exercise oversight over the DPCI and subs? By the way, when we talk about DPCI and subs, we are talking about the head of the DPCI, and we are also talking about the head of the subs. Now, the question is, why are they not also included in their act and in terms of ensuring? Because of, remember, I think, honorable members, one needs to also take into consideration that since now the Constitutional Court has declared Section 63A invalid and unconstitutional, then obviously the executive director is no longer appointed in terms of the public, the laws governing the public service. Now the question is, how are we then going to, or henceforth, especially when one takes into consideration that the current executive director is left with less than 9 months, if not 8 months, for his contract to lapse. Now the question is, in the event that is not renewed, or there are processes in order to fill that vacancy, what is it that is going to be followed in order to fill that particular vacancy? So this is the opportunity that when this particular process is concluded, such mechanisms are put in place. And remember, that is not what the IPID is saying, but that is what the Constitutional Court said. The Constitutional Court said one of the issues that needs to be looked at, and I just want to refer the committee to our submissions at paragraph 46, where we are quoting the courts, that is the Constitutional Courts at paragraph 22, and we quoted the following with the relevant paragraphs or the relevant sentences or findings in as far as that paragraph is concerned, where the court found, I quote, experience suggests that it is structural and operational autonomy that is important, along with a clear legal basis and mandate for a special body, department or unit. This is particularly important for law enforcement bodies. Transparent procedures for appointment and removal of the director, together with proper human resources mechanism management and internal controls, are important elements to prevent undue interference. Now, this interference I've already spoken to, that the involvement of the minister in the appointment of the executive director, according to the Constitutional Court, it is not supposed to be a process only that is supposed to be determined by the minister. But because of the Parliament is the one that appoints the executive director in terms of Section 6.2 of the IPID Act, then that particular process, it cannot just be left only to the minister, for the minister to deal with it. And it is for those reasons that we have also proposed those provisions, or rather those particular sections that the committee may consider in order to arrive at that particular findings of the Constitutional Court in addressing Section 63A. Now, let me also try to refer to paragraph 4.8, and I'm going to quote those sections that we have referred to of the, or those paragraph of the Constitutional Court's judgment in as far as the independence of the IPID and its executive director. Now, the court at paragraph 30 to 31 I quote, found as follows: it is axiomatic that public servants are government employees. They are beholden to government. They operate under government instructions and control. The authority to discipline and dismiss them vests in the relevant executive authority. This does not require parliamentary oversight. To subject the executive director of IPID to the same regime is to undermine or subvert his independence. It is not congruent with the Constitution. At that one, what then does the independence of IPID mean? Does it mean complete or sufficient independence? Admittedly, it is difficult to attempt to define the precise contours of a concept as elastic as this. It requires careful examination of a wide range of facts to determine this question. Among these are the method of appointment, the method of reporting, disciplinary proceedings, method of removal of the executive director from office, and security of tenure. However, this court has had occasion to deal with the independence of a similar institution in Helen Suzman Foundation and Glenister II. Although the two cases deal with the independence of the DPCI, whose mandate is different to that of IPID, they offer useful guidelines in giving substance to IPID's constitutionally guaranteed independence. They offer bright lights for us. We transverse this new era. Close quote. That is important guidelines in terms of how the committee then will have to go around in ensuring that Section 63A is amended and that the constitutionally guaranteed independence of IPID is achieved in as far as Section 63A is concerned. Now, in our submissions, we have, I know one of the questions is, that may probably be pondering around certain minds is, but when you do Section 63A in your remuneration and conditions of employment, why your paragraph A of Section 6.1 equates the executive director to the national commissioner? I think the Constitutional Court has made it very clear that you have to compare, and you cannot run away from that. Look at the independence of the DPCI. The executive director is an accounting officer. He is not just there for the purposes of investigating the offenses and misconduct, but he must also act as the head of that particular institution. Now, the question that needs to be asked is whether are we then going to say, in terms of the public service laws, this is what happens? Or maybe are we going to say, because now one needs to look at the number of employees that the executive director then manage in comparison to what the national commissioner or maybe the DPCI, but that is not what is supposed to be done at that particular moment when you compare the two. Because if you do that, then you will be losing sight of the fact that let's look at the other departments or even constitutional supporting bodies. Where are they? Now, in order for you to guarantee the security of tenure of that particular individual, why would you then say to this particular individual, you are going to be the accounting officer, you are going to look after this particular two powerful individuals, but in terms of your conditions of service are not as equal or even powerful or maybe on the same scale as that of that particular individual. Now the question is, will that particular individual then not undermine that particular person that is supposed to be investigating you? So it's not even about that, because of the guidance is there. We have to move away from the public service, or rather the laws governing the public service, and look at the constitutional mechanism of ensuring the security of tenure of the executive director. Now, maybe this last quote that I want to quote from the Constitutional Court's judgment at paragraph 38 of the judgment. I quote, the court found as follows. On the other hand, section 6, maybe let me just pause there, that the constitutional court doesn't say section 638 or section 66, which they've already declared invalid and unconstitutional. But what the constitutional court was saying, section 6 of the IPRE Act gives the minister enormous political powers and control over the executive director of IPRD. It gives the minister power to remove the executive director of IPRD from his office without parliamentary oversight. It is antithetical to the entrenched independence of IPRD envisaged by the Constitution, as it is tantamount to impermissible political management of IPRD by the minister. To my mind, this state of affairs creates room for the minister to invoke partisan political influence to appoint someone who is likely to pander to his whims or who is sympathetic to the minister's political orientation. This might lead to IPRD becoming politicized and being manipulated. Is this compatible with IPRD's independence as demanded by the Constitution and the IPRD? Certainly not. Close quote. Now, it is important that when the committee goes through and deliberate around this, look at those particular, what the court was saying in as far as the independence, especially when you look at Section 6. And take into consideration this particular findings. And one of the things that maybe I need to remind, or as I put, we need to remind the honorable members, is that findings are findings, and you, for one not to follow the findings or one to create his own finding out of that, then that particular process may be found as undermining the court. And an example is, if we recall in the matter of the former head of DPCI, who made the finding and played around the finding of the court and tried to justify his comments by saying the judge remarked, when in fact the judge had made a finding. And in terms of the subsequent even higher courts, and the SCA said that was a finding, and findings of the court are supposed to be complied with. So it is upon those bases that we are appealing to the committee, that the committee must try to follow and ensure that these particular submissions that are being made to assist the committee in arriving and making, the appropriate provisions of the Act and amendments in accordance with that particular judgment. And we then propose the following. In as far as Section 63A is concerned, we propose for a procedure for the recruitment of the executive director, which requires the advertisement of the vacant post in the Government Gazette and the national newspaper circulations. We have also proposed the listing of requirements relating to the requirement of a potential candidate for the position of executive director. For a non-renewable fixed term of office for the executive director of not less than 7 years and not exceeding 10 years. For the appointment of a panel of technical experts to assist the evaluation and nomination process of suitably qualified person for appointment to the office of the executive director. For a procedure to formalize the appointment of the executive director following confirmation of the minister's nomination of a suitably qualified candidate by the relevant parliamentary committee, and for a formalization of the appointment of the executive director, which includes the minister issuing a letter of appointment and employment contract and the signing of a performance agreement. Now, in as far as the remuneration and conditions of employment of the executive director, which is also find itself within the constraint of the findings of the constitutional court judgment, we propose the following, that the minister let me start from the top. The remuneration and other terms and conditions of employment of the executive director will from time to time be determined by the Minister of Police in consultation with the Minister of Finance and will not be lower than that of the National Commissioner of Police. The Minister to permit the Executive Director to vacate his or office on account of continued ill health or any other reason which the Minister may deem fit. Notice to vacate office must be given to the Minister at least 6 calendar months prior to the date on which Executive Director wishes to vacate office, unless the Minister grants a shorter period. That Minister must, during the 6 month calendar period, take steps to ensure that the office of the executive director is filled with the anticipated vacancy occurs. In the event of a vacancy, the minister must, in consultation with the relevant parliamentary committee, appoint a suitably qualified and competent person within the establishment of the directorate to act in the vacant executive director post until such time that a person is appointed to the office of the executive director in terms of Section 6. Now, this particular proposal, why we are proposing it, the current act makes it open. It means the minister may then go even outside the IPID Act. That is exactly what we have referred to in the previous comments and submissions that we have made, that the Constitutional Court was trying to avoid a situation where the minister would bring somebody who will come from outside just to come and do the minister's instructions or duty instructions within the IPID. That has to be avoided. Having somebody within the IPID is somebody that would understand the constitutional independence of that particular institution. The person will be able to hit the ground running because that particular individual would obviously be a senior management member who will then be in a position to can implement those particular processes. But remember, again, why we are saying with a parliamentary, in consultation with the relevant parliamentary committee. The fact of the matter is that who is responsible for the appointment of the executive director? It is Parliament. So why then, when it comes to an acting position, Parliament is not involved? So Parliament must be involved, and that's what we propose, and we also find that particular relevance in the judgment of the Constitutional Court. Now, we also say the executive director must also be prohibited from doing remunerative work outside the official duties of the executive director. This ensures that the executive director concentrates on the very important constitutional mandate of ensuring that he cleans the subs and ensures that SUPS does what is expected in terms of its mandate as entrenched in Section 2053 and also in terms of the Chapter 2 of the Constitution. Now, in as far as the last proposals that we are making, when it comes to the removal and the suspension of and the disciplinary process of the executive director, we align ourselves with the submissions that were made last week. However, with some additions. Let me take again the committee back to our submissions. The DPCI, in order for the committee to suspend the head of the the minister to suspend the head of the DPCI, two-thirds majority must first be obtained from the National Assembly. Equally, as the Constitutional Court has found and pronounced, then the executive director equally must enjoy the same protection. It means when the executive director must also be suspended, then two-thirds majority must also be obtained from the National Assembly. In as far as the proposals that were made, we align ourselves with those submissions in as far as the suspension, the removal, and the discipline of the executive director. In conclusion, what we are saying is that a bill without the inclusion of the above proposed provisions is inconsistent with the provisions of Section 206 of the Constitution and does not guarantee the protected independence of the IPID. Furthermore, the bill in its current form is inconsistent with the order of the Constitutional Court and may invite further intervention of the Constitutional Court in order to protect the independence of the IPID as pronounced by the court. In terms of the findings of both courts, the bill seeking to comply with the Constitutional Court orders in the McBride case must include method of appointment of the executive director, remuneration and conditions of service of the executive director, and suspension and removal from office of the executive director. It is submitted that the committee bill is inconsistent with the pronouncements and findings of the Constitutional Court in the McBride judgment and recommends that Parliament consider these submissions as well as the proposed provisions attached here too. If we look at section 6, capital A3 of the bill, it says the minister must, after the start of the commencement of the disciplinary proceedings by the committee, then suspend the executive director. That is exactly what the Constitutional Court has found to be unconstitutional, because it doesn't even give a proviso to say on condition that Parliament would have then or would have consulted or Parliament would have then approved that particular suspension. And it doesn't say, now, what in that particular form, again, what it does is that it doesn't even give the relevant committee or the committee an opportunity first to investigate, to establish the veracity of that particular allegations against the executive director. It is found to be, in terms of the law, especially the law of labor relations, to suspend someone pending investigations to establish the truthfulness of whether there is substance to the allegations against that particular employee. Equally, Parliament is also held those powers to say, yes, there may be substance in this particular allegations against the executive director. However, would still want to conduct an investigation. Nothing stops Parliament. Not that Parliament must then say we are going to conduct the disciplinary inquiry, because that may also be found to be futile. So in order for Parliament then to say we want to discipline, nothing stops Parliament also to say we suspend you pending the conclusion of the investigation, and if you find substance, then the suspension can still be extended. But however, if at that particular time, when the submission or the allegations are brought before Parliament and upon the decision of the relevant committee, the committee finds that there must be a disciplinary hearing, once again, then that particular clause of suspending the executive director will then come into operation. So it is on those bases that we are saying at 5.4 of our conclusions. We made ourselves available to submit this verbally at the invitation of the committee, and we thank you very much, Chairperson. We became aware only this morning that we are supposed to present. We trust that we were able to do so in the expectations of the Parliament, consistent with the submissions that have been made. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, sir, for the presentation. Maybe just to indicate to the members that have joined us lately where we are currently in the process, members will remember that we received 5 submissions last week. We did those public hearings. On Friday, we also received additional submissions apart from the joint submission that we had last week from ICAT and the Civilian Secretariat. ICAT also submitted an additional one that they just brought to the attention of the committee. Maybe just again, just to highlight before I give members an opportunity to engage, that of course there's other broader issues that was raised. Of course, the committee focuses on the bill before us, but let's give members an opportunity in any other institution that was to contribute. Yes. Any member? Honourable Mbele.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Just a question for clarity. So in terms of the proposal made for amendments of the appointment provisions. If I understood correctly, because the steps of the process, that's basically the sections 4.15, 4.15 as it's summarized there. So it's not so much about the sequence, the proposed sequence of appointments, because it does seem to still follow the minister's nomination and then confirmation by the committee. It's more about opening up and making more transparent the prerequisite grounds of the nomination by the minister. So the fact that it must be, the post must be advertised, it must be clear and detailed on the requirements for prospective candidates, and also the fact that the establishment of the panel of technical experts must be mandatory, because if I recall correctly, the current draft of the bill only says the minister may appoint a panel, so to make that a must. Is there anything else that I missed in terms of what the substance or the core of that is? Thanks, Chair.
Mbele, any other member? Right, you're welcome, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Mbele. Yes, in terms of the processes, what we are proposing that the process must be transparent. Now, in terms of the technical committee, when our proposal is that the chair of that particular committee must be somebody with extensive human rights background. The reason for that is that we must understand what Section 2066 provides and try to achieve, especially in as far as ensuring that the subs conduct themselves in the execution of their duties in terms of the provisions of Chapter 2 of the Constitution. So if you have somebody that chairs, then that particular person would be in a position then to ensure that you are going to have a balanced committee that also includes, you know, people with a background of criminal justice environment and also the security environment. That is what we propose, in fact, in terms of that committee's concern, so that the person that is going to be identified as a candidate as the executive director must understand what is expected of him in terms of Section 2066. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Any other member wants to raise anything? Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Thanks, Chair. Honourable members and my colleagues. Chair, we note, I'm Simon Tramane, I'm the Special Advisor to the Minister of Police. Chair, we note the presentation made by IPED. As we know that last week there was a joint presentation which was made by IPED and the Secretariat. The Minister gave directions in that regard. That's one. Issues that relate to remuneration and conditions of service of the executive director of IPED, he considers such issues to be issues of policy considerations. That now will first, he will need to discuss it with cabinet and follow other processes that relate to such issues. That guidance from the minister still stands. We can put it on record as a minister, as a minister, in saying, let alone that the minister is the supervisor of IPED. The minister did not even get or was afforded an opportunity to recite of this presentation to make inputs and guidance where applicable. We also understand that the IPED as an entity, it is capable enough of making its own submission. But it is important that, as he advised the minister, that any submission that will come from either from IPED and or the secretariat and or jointly on issues that it did not have sight of or on issues that it was not taken on board of, that presentation will not represent him as the Minister of Police. In closing, Chairperson, it is still the view of the Minister that the current committee bill is published. It's supported, of course, with further engagement and any other issues that relate to remuneration, I repeat, and conditions of service of the executive director will need to be dealt with at a later stage, because there is an intention in any event to consider the amendment of the IPED Act. I thank you, Shepard.
Thank you very much for that. Maybe just a follow-up question to the department. Of course, there is the, let's say, the narrow issues that we define as a committee. Of course, you indicated the wider issues. I just want to know the narrow issues. Was there any consultation with the executive authority? And then, secondly, on these broader issues today, was there any discussions with the executive authority? I just want to get it on record. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The executive director is on leave. The submissions were made and signed by the executive director. At this stage, we are not in a position to can say whether the executive director consulted or not. But I think, Chair, in terms of the IPID as an institution, and as we have already stated, Chair, I think one of the issues that must be considered is that I think sometime last, I think on the 26th, we had a meeting with the minister and we had presented this particular documents that were submitted together with the Civilian Secretariat and IPID on the in the previous week to the minister. My understanding is that minister has, importantly so, as the previous speaker has indicated, is the legal advisor to the minister and has the responsibility of ensuring that the minister is adequately and properly advised in terms of those submissions, one, and in terms of that particular judgment of the Constitutional Court. Now, my impression that I'm getting from the legal advisor is that the Constitutional Court judgment was not taken into consideration and probably did not even try to advise minister accordingly. But the fact of the matter is that, Chairperson, we are not going to, in as far as our presentation is concerned, going to concern ourselves with issues that the accounting officer ought to have probably taken with the minister, which we don't know. If we knew, we'd be in a position to get an account and explain to the committee whether the executive director indeed did have that particular discussion. But Chairperson, I just want to, in as far as the Chairperson was talking about the broader and the narrow issues, and it is important when I do so that I refer the committee to the Constitution, rather the North Gauteng High Court judgment at paragraphs 22 and also at paragraph 29. And of importance in paragraph 22 is the following paragraph, which reads, I quote, each of these mechanisms for ensuring independence in structural and operational autonomy, a clear legal basis for the body, transparent procedures for appointment and removal, etc., serve a purpose. The anti-corruption body must be protected from undue political interference. Now, at 29, I'm going to refer or rather quote the following. I quote, hence, if Parliament fails to create an institution that appears from the reasonable standpoint of the public to be independent, it has failed to meet one of the objective benchmarks of independence. Let's remember that the North Gauteng High Court judgment was confirmed by the Constitutional Court. And in as far as the remuneration is concerned, Chair, I've said, both the courts went at length, that is the Gauteng High Court and the Constitutional Court, went at length. I think in terms of the Constitutional Court judgment, I may have read about 5 pages relating to comparison between the DPCI and the IPID. Now, when we go to the SAPS Act, which the Constitutional Court said, that particular the independence of DPCI is not entrenched in the Constitution, but by legislation, because DPCI accounts to the National Commissioner. That's what the Constitutional Court said. But when you go to that particular SAPS Act, you find the remuneration and conditions of the DPCI head provided for. And those particular conditions, provisions would say the remuneration and conditions of the national head of the DPCI shall not be lower than that of the Deputy National Commissioner. It's very clear. Now, what they're saying is that what you have for the national head of the DPCI must then also be protected and be the same as that of the head of the IPID. So it cannot be that. Now, when it comes, when the Constitutional Court said the executive director must not be subject to the regime of the public service, then you create a policy for the appointment and remuneration and conditions of the executive director. That is our understanding of the Constitutional Court judgment, that it cannot be policy, but it must be entrenched in that particular act. Thank you, Chair.
Can we just maybe get a confirmation whether the executive authority was consulted on this presentation, yes or no? I'll tell you why it's sitting... Yeah. Yes. Yeah, no, because it's important. On the one hand, it's about the process of consultation. As the committee, we must be satisfied that the internal processes was followed by the relevant departments, even if it's a committee bill. Of course, Rule 279 of the NA comes into play if it's a bill from the executive, but we just need, from an assurance point of view, I mean, the minister, was he affirmative of your presentation?
Thank you, Chair. I've been advised that when the minister took office, even though it was not specifically about this particular presentation, but the provisions of the act that was presented to the minister, minister was appraised of the amendments of the act, that is the whole act. But in that whole act were this particular provisions of Section 6 when the minister was consulted. So that at that time when he was consulted, Section 6, as we are presenting and as we are proposing, the minister was brought into, it was brought to the attention of the minister at that time. Thank you, Chair.
The specific presentation of this morning didn't go through his table.
Chair, if you recall, in the previous presentation, we only presented on the proposals of the suspension, the removal, and the discipline of the executive director. And thereafter, we adjourned. And subsequent thereto, there was consultation amongst IPID, And whatever happened, I do not want to say, and I don't want to mislead the committee by saying the executive director has done. As I've said, I'm not aware of any consultation personally. And even my supervisor just told me that she's not aware. But it may be, we don't know. And we are not going to say anything beyond that, Chair.
The simple question, you know, did the minister sign off on the submission this morning, yes or no? It's just simple, straight, yes or no?
Not according to my knowledge, Chairperson.
Any other members? Honourable Colonel Barnard?
Yeah, I'm curious as to the questioning. Is there some reason you, Chair, are asking if a submission by the IPID should have been somehow signed off or shown to the Minister before coming to this committee? I'm just curious about what reasoning there would be. I mean, the relationship to me between the IPID and the SAFs is broken down to such an extent it's going to take a year to start recovering. I really can't see the head of the IPID taking anything to the SAPS and saying, what do you think? Because basically he's fighting for his independence against the SAPS. They're on other sides of the fence in this regard. So please, I'm most interested in your question.
No, it's to do with the whole position of the executive authority in the legislative framework. Of course, this is a committee bill. But in the normal course of legislation with policies involved, any legislation that will come to Parliament that's got a policy implication must be submitted by the specific minister, the executive authority. And that's then referred to the Speaker, and the Speaker must make then a determination. Although that rule is not applicable here, I just want to ensure in terms of consultation that we don't, down the road, if we finish with deliberations, that the executive authority raises the issue or there might be a further dispute, legal or factual. So I just want to ensure that all role players have been briefed in that, where that specific, you know, presentation is coming from. That is just to ensure that we all on the same page. That's quite critical. Because if we've got a situation where a department submits during the process of even a committee bill and the executive authority didn't sign off, it will raise various questions. Who's got the final say in terms of that. So I think it's important that we just know exactly what processes were followed. Right, any other member on this presentation? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Thank you. We will move then to the next presentation. Yeah, the council, yeah, the Legal Resources Centre. So the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution, they're very much welcome. And to sit in front and also introduce their delegation, you're very much welcome.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Lawson Naidoo. I'm the Executive Secretary of CASAC, the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution. Just to clarify that the submission on behalf of CASAC was made by the Legal Resources Centre as our attorneys advising us on this matter. And the reason that the LRC were involved in this is that, as has been referred to already, CASAC played the role of an amicus curiae in the High Court matter in the McBride case. We did not participate in the Constitutional Court confirmation hearing, but were active participants in the High Court matter and were advised by and represented by the Legal Resources Centre in that case. Chair, just to advise and inform the committee members here that CASAC is a public interest organization, a non-governmental organization who conduct advocacy, lobbying, as well as litigation on a range of constitutional issues, and in particular looking at institutions of governance and their independence and autonomy and effectiveness in complying with their constitutional mandates. And it was that factor that led us to participate in the McBride case as an amicus, as I've just said. In that case, I think it's worth noting by this committee that we took the unusual step in that case as an amicus to ask the court to allow us to lead evidence in the matter, not just to make legal argument. And we did so because we felt that there was a case to be made for hearing the expert evidence of Mr. David Bruce, who I'm sure this committee is familiar with, and he led and provided expert evidence in writing about the nature and role of the IPED, about the importance of independence to its legitimacy and effectiveness, in particular in investigating corruption and the excessive use of force by the police. And that expert evidence spoke to the issue of what constitutes the meaning of adequate independence in relation to IPED. It was evidence that was welcomed by the court, and the judge in the North Gauteng High Court commended CASAC for leading that evidence, providing the court with that evidence, which certainly assisted the court in reaching its conclusions in that matter. We also, as part of our arguments, highlighted the importance of IPED in combating corruption, torture, and assault by police officers, and these are matters that have been traversed in other presentations before this committee, and I'm certainly not going to repeat what has been said by others, either verbally or in writing. The second aspect that we drew the court's attention to in the McBride matter was we sought to provide a comparative study of foreign law as it was used as a means of emphasizing, once again, the importance of independence of police oversight bodies. And this position, as I say, was borne out by comparative foreign law, and in particular, the examples that we used from Kenya and Scotland. These countries are amongst those that have enacted statutes that create independent police oversight bodies and that require parliamentary oversight for the removal or suspension of the persons that direct or govern those oversight bodies. Coming to the bill before us today, Chair, and I'm going to be very brief this morning because I think it's, much has been said already. As CASAC, we support the proposed amendments to the IPED Amendment Bill as they have been tabled. We believe that these amendments give effect to the judgment of the Constitutional Court that declared that the head of IPED needs to be protected or insulated from undue ministerial influence in her or his suspension or removal from office. We would therefore commend the committee for that position. However, we note, as others have, that the committee, understandably, has taken a minimalist view in addressing the IPED Act and seeking merely to conform to the Constitutional Court judgment. We certainly echo the views of others that have said that Parliament should have taken the opportunity to review the Act more broadly, to reflect on it as it relates to the institutional autonomy of the IPED, so as to enhance and bolster its effectiveness in dealing with both structural and operational matters. I think recent experience and revelations in the public domain have shown us, as South Africans, how weakening key independent institutions of state undermine our democracy and allow a culture of impunity to take root. And I'm sure that that's something that this committee will be very aware of and wanting to deal with. And I think on this note, it's worth reminding the committee, it's worth pointing out that it has taken almost 2 years, the time frame given by the Constitutional Court, for these amendments to reach the stage of the committee. And we, in this vein, wish to commend the Portfolio Committee for taking the initiative and tabling this as a committee bill. But in doing so, I think we must pause and lament on the inaction and the abdication of responsibility by the Minister of Police and the Civilian Secretariat in failing to take heed of the Constitutional Court judgment and taking the necessary steps to remedy the defects in law that were identified by the Constitutional Court. In that vein, it's worth reminding ourselves that the genesis of this bill, that is, amendment bill that is before us today, is that it was the attitude of the former Minister of Police towards the incumbent head of IPED, Mr. Robert McBride. And it is clear from the court papers and the judgments that emanated from the High Court as well as the Constitutional Court that the erstwhile minister's only interest in the matter was the removal of Mr. McBride, by any means necessary. And this is borne out by the fact that on the eve of the Constitutional Court hearing, the then Minister of Police conceded on almost all the issues before the court that had been raised either by the head of IPED or by the amicus in the case, and asking only that the court rubber stamp the unlawful action that had already taken place in seeking to suspend Mr. McBride. I think in that light, we therefore endorse the submissions made by APCOF, the African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum, that also deal with issues of the security of tenure of the head of IPED, matters dealing with financial independence and remuneration that has just been discussed by the previous speaker. It also alludes to the importance of perceptions of independence, and this issue of the perceptions of independence of the head of an independent body is something that was canvassed by CASAC before the High Court, drawing on the Constitutional Court judgment in the Glenister 2 case. In particular, we would support an appointment procedure that is conducted via a committee of parliament with the endorsement of the support of two-thirds of the members of the House, as well as a clear process to be followed in the event that an executive director is to be suspended or removed from office. We endorse the view that this must follow due process and be open and transparent and clear to all. I think the process that we've seen in another committee of this parliament at the moment dealing with an inquiry into the fitness of, to hold office of the public protector demonstrates the dangers in failing to have a clear policy in place to deal with such important matters. Given the time constraints faced by this committee, we concede that it may not be feasible to consider and incorporate all of these additional amendments that have been raised before the committee. Parliament has little time left to finalize this bill to allow it to comply with the judgment of the Constitutional Court by the 6th of September. But we hope that the committee will return to these issues in the next Parliament to strengthen the hand of IPED and thereby ensure that we have a more accountable police service in South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for your input, Afrika Manadu. We appreciate it. Let's get the members' questions. Is Honourable Kalibona?
Thank you, Chair. I'm presuming you're talking about the then Minister Nhleko, because no, we've had a lot of them, so I wanted to make sure I had the right one, the one I believe who should be paying out of his pocket for all of this. And a question sort of through you to the Chair, to the committee. We've had a number of inputs, and a lot of the input has been disregarded, although it would probably be highly beneficial for those points to be inserted into this, but we're saying, oh no, we must just focus on exactly what the ruling was. But let us take into consideration what is being said here, because it's been said by a number of really top bodies in the country that actually a lot more work could be done on this. And is there anything stopping us working 7 days a week and inserting additional changes to this bill? Why are we disregarding everything and saying, well, we just have to do that? I mean, we're an independent entity. We can actually expand what we do so that we don't have to come back to this bill in the new parliament in another year, another 2 years. Then they're waiting another 3 years and the secretariat never going to do it and the minister's never going to do it. We're going to have the same situation. I really think we should be looking very carefully at what's being suggested, and instead of just tossing it aside because it's not down that thin line of, yes, we have to tick the boxes for the Constitutional Court, and we should actually be considering some of these extremely pertinent points. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe before we give Afrika Naidoo, maybe I must just respond to Honourable Kalibona. Remember, there is all the submissions last week, and I think as a committee of political parties, we agree there should be a major revamp of the IPED bill. I think there's common cause about that. Of course, the preferable route is the normal legal process, the executive authority launches and so on, and it comes to Parliament during that process. But the dilemma we're sitting with is the question of time. Remember, we've got until about the 11th of September for the parliamentary process to conclude. And if there is, for instance, the proposal to widen it, that means we will have to go back to the public. We will have to go with a revised motion or permission in the House. The House is only resuming on 21 August. If we get to the House maybe mid-September, then we're talking about additional 3-4 weeks for public comment on those. It's just in terms of time, in terms of the parliamentary program, one must be quite realistic. And remember, a lot of these issues, there's also additional issues, I think, that hasn't been on the table this last week that we will also have to look at. I don't want to put them on the table now, but just in terms of procedure, I think the committee wants to, we want to ensure that we comply with the Constitutional Court. That's critical for Parliament to do. I mean, we had some instances previous years that Parliament didn't comply with the Constitutional Court. And I think we're already very much pressed. It's going to be a hard time. But we, I think from the Portfolio Committee side, that's why we undertook this process in December, because our analysis was the Secretariat is not moving, there's nothing to before Parliament. And the dilemma is a lot of the issues of substantive nature it is preferable that it goes through the subcommittees of Cabinet. There must be public input. Remember, a lot of these issues that's now been before this committee this week hasn't been scrutinized by the public. The public only responded to the issues that is in the bill that is been published in the Gazette. So a lot of the issues that's been raised here by the various institutions, there's been no public comment. So Parliament will fail that test if you want to expand. So that is a short answer, but we will give the experts of Parliament, the legal advisers, for us an opportunity to deal with that later today.
Thank you. Look, I think you're right. I mean, in the ideal world, I would like very much to take everything on board now. But I think we must make it clear to those who are giving input and who have gone to a great deal of effort to give substantive input and say, look, we have to focus because we were let down by the Minister and the Secretariat. This committee has taken it upon themselves to do this. We have to make sure we hit that deadline. Isn't it the 6th of September? 6th of September, it's a week shorter than you thought. But we'll keep all of the inputs and then start again with this mess of a bill. Thank you.
Ideal process situation, I mean, the committee will towards the end of this year conclude its work for this term or the beginning of next year, and in the legacy report, ideally, you should actually then have a looking forward chapter, and in that you must then include all these specific issues for the sixth parliament. That would be, from a process point of view, maybe the route, but I mean, we're not there yet, so let's park this discussion, but I mean, the reality is the issue of time. Maybe one question for Advocate Naidu, and maybe, I mean, he's one of the most preeminent constitutional scholars in the country. There was the argument made earlier this morning that the current bill is unconstitutional. Now, I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't want you to differ in public. But what is your take? I mean, because at the end of the day, if we proceed, we want to ensure also the committee that anything that we take to the House must be constitutional. What would be your views if you want to add anything on that in that regard?
Thank you, Chair. I don't think that there's, my personal view, I don't think that there's anything in the current amendment bill before this committee that is unconstitutional. I think the reason that many of the public submissions that you've received have endorsed, albeit the limited scope of those amendments, I think perhaps the Helen Suzman Foundation, the minor amendment that they're proposing to clarify what we mean by committee to a parliamentary committee is a sensible amendment, which I would encourage the committee to adopt. Beyond that, I think, whether the IPED bill itself, or the IPED Act, rather, is unconstitutional is a matter that's for debate. I think what is encouraging is your commitment, Chair, that the Act itself needs a major overhaul, and that it needs a revamp in order to bring it into line, both with the constitutional mandate, but also with the practical realities of the relationship between SAPS and IPED. I don't think that we can ignore those practical realities in crafting the relationship between IPED and the Minister. And, you know, the previous colleague for IPED spoke about the Constitutional Court having spoken to the extent that the IQUD should be at no less of an independent level than the DPCI. That is a very, very minimum, because at the end of the day, IPED has the responsibility of oversight over the DPCI. So the level of independence of IPED should necessarily be at a higher level than that. So I think if this committee approaches the IPED bill in that regard, then it would be on the right track, and in terms of identifying exactly how the bill can become more attuned with what its constitutional mandate is.
Other members, any questions to Advocate Davis? Thank you very much. We want to thank KZAC for the input. We appreciate it very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Right, thank you, members. We will then continue. We will now have the Center for Applied Legal Studies from the University of the Witwatersrand. They are welcome to join us in front and then introduce themselves as well. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, and to all the honourable members and all the guests. Thank you, firstly, for inviting us to submit comments. My name is Lubabalo Mabenga, and this is my colleague, Thamsanqa Morakabi, and we're both from the Centre for Applied Legal Studies. At the outset, let me apologise for the projector issue. We didn't bring an adapter for us, and therefore are unable to connect it. So we're, like I said before, from the Center for Applied Legal Studies. We're an institute at the University of the Witwatersrand. We do work mainly in research advocacy and strategic litigation around basic services, business and human rights, environmental justice, gender, and the rule of law. Shortly, our presentation will firstly focus around just our interpretation of the McBride judgment and some problems of ambiguity that we see in terms of the amendment. And we will also speak about the discretion that it gives the minister to suspend once a disciplinary proceeding has been initiated.
Thank you, Chair. We, as CALS, we think that it's important in our submission on the amendment bill to refer to a few extracts from the Constitutional Court and McBride as a ground the arguments made in our submissions. If you look at paragraph 39 of the Constitutional Court judgment, it says that the minister cannot unilaterally interfere with the executive director's tenure. The court held that this goes against the institutional and functional independence of the IPED. In paragraph 40 of the Constitutional Court, the court held that that without this institutional and functional independence of IPED, the minister can usurp the power of the executive director under the guise of political accountability or oversight. Furthermore, in paragraph 43, the court emphasizes that the manner in which the minister dealt with the McBride matter demonstrates how invasive the minister's powers are. And then they emphasize that what made matters worse is that the minister acted unilaterally. From these extracts from the judgment, it is clear that the amendment that the Constitutional Court envisioned was one in which any power that the minister may exercise over the tenure of the executive director should be subject to parliamentary oversight. And this exercise of power under tenure includes the power to suspend, to institute disciplinary hearings, and to remove the executive director from office. The plain reading of the proposed amendment, Section 6A, subsection 3A, is that after any start of the proceedings contemplated in Section 61A, the minister has the power to suspend. We argue and agree with the previous speakers that this is the matter that the Constitutional Court has already declared on, that the minister has no power to suspend without consulting with the committee. CALS put forward to the committee that it gives the minister unilateral interference with the executive director's tenure insofar as suspensions are concerned. The proper reading of the McBride judgment, Kells argues, envisions that the minister's power to interfere anyway with the tenure of the executive director should be subject to oversight by the committee. In this capacity, the committee gives effect to the independence and the appearance of independence of IPED, as emphasized by the Constitutional Court. As such, Kells proposes that the amendment should clearly state that the minister's powers to interfere with the executive director's tenure by suspension be subject to oversight of the committee, meaning that the minister must consult the committee any time after the start of the proceedings contemplated in Section 1A before suspending the executive director.
And then the other part of our submission is then in the alternative where the minister is given the discretion to suspend. We suggest that that discretion shouldn't be as wide as it is in the current form. What Carl submits to this committee is that any exercise of discretion ought to be guided by determinable principles. And this is important because when proceedings are instituted, that doesn't automatically mean that the person who they've been instituted against can be suspended. And in fact, that the exercise of that decision itself, and the IPED speaker earlier referred to labor law, is one that ought to be exercised in certain conditions, such as where there's reasonable or there are reasons to believe that they may interfere with an investigation, or there are reasons to believe that they may cause harm where it is that they remain in that position. And we would suggest simply adding those principles to that suggestion where the committee is determined to give the minister that discretion to suspend on its own without consulting the committee. And we think that inserting those would then act as a guideline in order to prevent any undue interference or suspensions for no good reason, as would happen in the case where it is that the minister simply has the broad range. We don't suggest that this is something that would survive, for instance, a court challenge, but we think that there is no reason to allow it to get to that stage when the committee could insert simple principles that would guide the exercise of that discretion by the minister. So, in conclusion, we as Cal say that the minister cannot exercise the power to suspend the executive director unilaterally, and Carl's proposes that the amendment should clearly state the minister can only exercise his or her power to suspend after consultation with the committee, and that in the alternative, Carl proposes that we should make it clear what principles guide that discretion to suspend if it is that the minister is given that discretion. That is all from us.
Thank you very much to the Centre for Applied Legal Studies. Honourable members, any questions or input? Thank you very much. We appreciate and we thank you very much for your effort and coming to Cape Town. Thank you very much. Honourable members, then we will then go to the presentation of the Parliamentary Liaison Office of the South African Catholic Bishops Conference. They're not physically present, but we'll ask the content advisor, Dr. Kinnis, to stand in for the clergy this morning.
My dear brothers and sisters. Chair, the Catholic Bishops Conference submission is dated 28th of June. Introduction. The Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Offices is an office of the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference, tasked with liaising between the Church and Parliament, so government, commenting on issues of public policy and making submissions on legislation. The CPLO welcomes the opportunity to comment on the proposed amendments to the IPED Act. Commence. Two. An independent police watchdog organization is a vital factor in ensuring that the nation's police services carries out its duties professionally, ethically, and constitutionally. This not only helps to maintain public trust and confidence in the police, it also protects individual police officers and police and the police service as a whole from unwarranted and malicious attacks. Such a body must be truly independent of the police service and must be seen to be so. This consideration was at the heart of the Constitutional Court's findings in McBride versus the Minister of Police and another, 2016 ZACC 30. If the executive director of such a body, of a body such as IPED, can be suspended or dismissed from office solely by the Minister of Police, it cannot be said that a sufficient degree of independence exists. Furthermore, such a provision effectively prevents Parliament from exercising the necessary oversight regarding regarding an executive decision with far-reaching implications. Accordingly, we strongly support the proposed amendments to the IPED Act. They will help us to ensure that the executive director of IPED, and therefore to a large extent the organization as a whole, can carry out his or her duties, knowing that only a two-thirds majority of the National Assembly can remove him or her from office. We also support the role given to a committee of the National Assembly in the proposed Section 6A1A of the IPED Act. It is appropriate that the body consisting of public representatives should be tasked with making a finding as to the fitness for office of the IPED director, just as it would do in the case of the head of the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation. We are available to address the committee orally. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kinnis, for that presentation. Then, members, the next presentation is from the Alan Sussman Foundation, but as I've indicated earlier, their flight, due to flight changes, they will only be able to present at 12. Oh, the year already. Wow. Name the airline. You're very much welcome to come and join us in France. Yeah, thank you. Welcome. You're welcome to introduce yourselves and then continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I am Kimera Chetty. I'm a legal researcher from the Helen Sussman Foundation. I'm joined by my colleague Mira Brill, who's also a legal researcher. Through your indulgence, Chair, we apologize for being late for the meeting. Chair, the Helen Sussman Foundation has had sight of the amendment bill, indeed has made written submissions to the committee on this bill. I trust that the committee has had sight of our submission and is familiar with it. And so I shan't traverse the facts of the McBride case that led us to this point. Again, I'm sure the committee is also well familiar with that. But to this end, the foundation has three main concerns that we would like the committee to be alive to and possibly also respond to us at this meeting or later. And the first is just the process that led us to this point of the amendment bill, Chair. The Helen Sussman Foundation, as you would have seen in our submission, had been party to stakeholder engagements, particularly in a draft amendment bill that was put before us in November 2017. Party to those stakeholder engagement sessions were other civil society organizations, many of whom are here today and have also made submissions on this current bill to the committee. Somewhere between November 2017 and now, July of 2018, the foundation finds itself in a position of concern as to what the refined amendment bill looks like in comparison to that draft amendment bill that was really the creation of IPED and the Civilian Secretariat Police. So the HSF is alive to the time constraints placed by the court order of the Constitutional Court that this bill must be enacted by a certain date. And so not being privy to the process between November and July of 2018, the foundation would really be put in a better position to comment on the process in that interim if the committee can make us alive to those events.
But I think that is an important question you raise, because that is actually why we're here today as a committee, dealing with the committee bill. Because remember, the Constitutional Court gave 2 years for Parliament to fix this. Now, normally, the departments that are relevant, they must ensure that they deal with that matter as soon as possible. Now, if I remember correctly, verbatim last week, there was a presentation that indicated that the department only started in May, you know, with that internal process. But remember, that process that you were part of, involved in consultation-wise, was part of the executive or the department's process to amend the bill. But in December, there was a decision by this committee due to a letter that we received from the civilian secretariat that they won't be able to get through cabinet their bill that our committee will engage. So that process, we can't unfortunately indicate where they are, you know, whether that process is ongoing, you know, where they look at other issues as well. But that's a different process. What we're talking about is the committee bill aimed at dealing with the defects indicated by the Constitutional Court. So that is a different process you're actually referring to. So that process might be still be ongoing, or it may be, you know, we can't really say, maybe we must ask the civilian secretariat, but, you know, we are busy with the committee bill as such.
The bill that was seen by the Helen Sussman Foundation, was that a revision of the whole act, or was that only, again, what we're doing?
Remember the proceedings here today is the bill that was adopted by this committee, the committee bill, and it was published in the Government Gazette. I think they referred to the departmental process that was, you know, embarked upon a year or two ago. So I think that is maybe the question they raised. So I think it's important that we make the distinction.
What I'm asking is, that bill that the Secretariat has somewhere, was that a review of the entire bill, or was that just, it was, lots of nodding of heads. So it was a review of the whole bill, and it's evaporated, and we don't know where it is, and here we go. We're having to do their job for them.
Yeah, remember, we can only react to that bill that is somewhere if it's referred by, if it's referred by the minister to the speaker, and the speaker to us. We're not there. That's way too late for that, unfortunately. So, that's a short maybe explanation where we are in terms of this bill. You're welcome.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. I think it's an interesting point then raised. As you say, the committee convenes now and in the previous public hearing session to deal with the defects identified by the Constitutional Court. In our submission, we do make substantive contributions, particularly on the current bill as it stands, and so we appreciate the work of the committee in complying with the constitutional order to date. But we think what must be considered and what the committee needs to be alive to, that in being compliant with the Constitutional Court order envisages more, and that really is the point of our submission, than a technical compliance with an incorporation of the SAFS Act into the new IPED Act. And that is what this current bill seeks to do. So our raising of this really, like you say, a bill that arose from a stakeholder engagement session or two sessions between IPED and the CSP, and that this is a committee bill, we take that point, and we're sympathetic to the position of the committee in what it can do insofar as it can do it within the time constraints. But we think that in bringing the bill, the current bill, and making it compliant with what the Constitutional Court envisaged, especially in its deconstruction of what independence for the institution means being alive to things that are broader than merely the removal process of the executive director, which is what the current bill seeks to address. How the committee then engages with the CSP is beyond our, you know, the scope of what we can suggest, but we do encourage that the committee takes that on as a consideration of following up with that, why that process, which was quite an encouraging process, certainly to us as civil society, being asked to come in and comment and present at these workshops, why that process fell away. To this end, we've also had the benefit of reading the submission of the African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum, APCOF, to the extent that their submission encourages a reconsideration of those broader consideration of what structural and operational independence means for IPED, which is what our understanding of what the Constitutional Court envisaged. We endorse their submission and we support it. We don't seek to repeat it in our submission, but insofar as those recommendations contained in their submission relate to the appointment procedures, the removal procedures, we support that as a consideration. We are sympathetic to the time constraints that the committee finds itself in. And so in our submission, we make a suggestion as to how this can potentially be remedied without compromising the work of the committee and without putting the committee in a position where it potentially finds itself in contempt of the court order because it can't meet those time requirements. That suggestion is found in Section 2 of our submission, and particularly 2.3. After us endorsing APCOP's submission, the first suggestion is that given the time constraints and in order to avoid being in contempt of the constitutional court order, the committee must ensure compliance by enacting the bill before 6 September 2018. B of that section says, while the bill may meet strict compliance with the order, it is limited in scope insofar as it only addresses removal. We do not believe that enacting this bill can constitute the final step of bringing the Act in line with the Constitution. We therefore urge that beyond this legislative step, which is enacting these sections of the current bill into law, the committee urgently considers further amending the IPED Act to address the concerns identified by APCOF in their submissions under the headings Appointment of the Executive Director and Removal of the Executive Director. We believe that assurances in this regard from the committee may avoid the need for a legal challenge in order to make the IPED Act constitutionally compliant. The AGCF thus urges continued legislative review and engagement with stakeholders in order to strengthen both the IPED Act and the institution. Chair, through you, if I can just elaborate on what we mean in that two-step process. We recognize that we're now in July. This Act must be enacted by September early, in the first week. That's fine. We think both things can still be done. So we support the interim order of the High Court, and that was certified by the Constitutional Court in this bill being enacted into law, but we don't think that that necessarily needs to close the process of amending the IPED Act to make it constitutionally compliant, especially where somewhere through the cracks, this draft bill, which you think that came out in November 2017 between stakeholders and at those sessions, we think that bill is still quite important. We appreciate that through APCOP's submission that those things are brought back into the conversation. In addition to other structural and operational considerations, such as remuneration of the executive director, security of tenure, important considerations that speak to what the Constitutional Court envisaged when it envisaged how to make IPED at least as independent as the DPCI, if not more so. And that's really what was endorsed in the High Court order carried through to the Constitutional Court order. So we ask that the committee take that two-stage process under consideration of this not being the final step of merely a technical compliance with the Constitutional Court. Really, Chair, unless there are specific questions, the rest of our submission is quite self-explanatory. The recommendations that we make as pertain to the current bill is really just one. It's really just that there is in the IPED Act a definition of committee already contained in the definitions. That definition speaks to Section 11 of the IPED Act, which refers to a management committee. But the word committee and the usage of that phrase is also used later on in the Act. We believe that makes the Act potentially ambiguous, especially given that the committee of Parliament that is convened to consider taking a resolution over the removal of the executive director, clarity around that committee is quite important. Our suggestion is merely insertion of the word relevant parliamentary before the word committee in the proposed Section 6A1A to bring the clause in line with the wording in Section 6.2 of the IPED Act. To make the distinction of the management committee, to make that clear, distinct from the parliamentary committee, we then should suggest addition of the words and as contemplated in sections 12, 13, and 14 in the definition of committee that's already found in section 1 of the IPED Act. that makes it quite clear that you don't have to go in and change sections 12, 13, and 14 to use the words management committee. It should be read in. Lastly, that the committee considers the addition of the definition of parliamentary committee in section 1 of the IPED Act in a way that describes the specific committee referred to in section 6.2 of the IPED Act and section 6A of the proposed amendment. This definition must make clear that the relevant parliamentary committee which is empowered to appoint the executive director in section 6.2 is the same parliamentary committee referred to in the proposed section 6A. This distinction is important in order to differentiate it from the committee as contemplated in sections 11, 12, and 13 and 14 of the IPED Act, which concern the management committee. Really, Chair, I mean, insofar as the current bill allows us to engage with the content of it,
I just want to please ask the department, you know, we try and keep proceedings orderly. If you want to have discussions, please have it outside. Thank you. You can continue.
Thank you, Chair. That is the extent of which the foundation wishes to make substantive comments on the current bill as it stands. We support the efforts of the committee to obviously comply, and we support this bill and its enactment as a compliance mechanism, a measure with the Constitutional Court order, but our sincere hope is that this is not the final step in bringing the IPED Act in line. We're also happy to take any questions on our submission.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Members? Thank you very much. We want to thank you very much for your input, and we appreciate it. We will take that into consideration. Honourable members, we will take now a 20-minute tea break. And when we come back, we will ask the parliamentary legal advisers to do us, to give us an analysis of all the presentations and any possible way forward. Thank you. 20 minutes. Thank you.
Couple of preliminary points before I go into the individual comments or and our responses there too. Sorry, my name is Michael Prince. Like the Chair said, I am from Parliament Legal Services. Chair, in principle, we have no objection to the amendment proposed, being proposed by the various commentators. We do not, however, support the argument that the bill does not fully give effect to the Constitutional Court order in the McBride matter. And there are reasons for saying so, and that will be made clear when we respond to the individual comments. Furthermore, Chair, and just to reiterate what you mentioned earlier, the committee must just note that any substantive amendment to the bill at this stage will require this committee to approach the Assembly again for permission to amend other provisions of the Act, and that is in terms of NA Rule 286(4), paragraph C. Also, it is worth highlighting that any additional amendments which would be of a substantive nature, as is the case here, would have to be advertised again for public comment in order to comply with Section 59(1) of the Constitution that mandates Parliament to facilitate public involvement in its lawmaking process. Just waiting for the. It's on my screen, Chair. I don't know where they. Ah,
how it will appear there. Chair, I don't know whether my matrix have been made available to the members.
Yes.
I can see it on my screen. I don't know how I can display it there. Big enough? Chair, just an explanatory note to explain the matrix that we developed. So it appeared to us that most of the written submissions received commented on an alternative bill other than the bill that was published, that was adopted by the Portfolio Committee on Police. So legal services prepared the matrix to respond to the comments only in as far as they pertain to the clauses in the draft amendment bill. The submissions were accordingly organized clause by clause, starting with a lot of general submissions, and these are submissions that are generally in support of the bill, but mostly submissions that fall outside the scope of the amendment bill. They were lumped under the general section, as they didn't speak to this particular clause of the bill. So to start with, and they're in no particular order, this is how I received them, the African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum, they supported the proposed amendments in Section 6 of the IPED Act to provide for parliamentary oversight in relation to suspension, discipline, and or removal of the executive director. That's a comment that we just noted. The second comment, and these are all legal issues that we highlighted. They were concerned that there were no criteria or discretion provided for the suspension, discipline, or removal of the executive director. Our response to that was that the court in the McBride matter ordered that Section 17DA3-7 of the SAFS Act must apply to the suspension and removal of the executive director, pending the correction of Section 6(6) of the IPED Act. We therefore felt that the court considered the provisions of the SAFS Act sufficient to deal with suspension and removal of the executive director. An argument can be made that it must be expanded. But our argument is, for purposes of this exercise, the court felt that those provisions were sufficient to deal with the removal and suspension of the executive director. They also proposed that two further amendments to strengthen the independence of IPED, one being able to make policy recommendations directly to the minister, secondly, to further define corruption and provide for bribery, and to include attempted murder by a police officer. These, with respect, are matters of policy consideration and falls outside the scope of the amendment bill, and therefore we did not comment on them. The same goes for the fourth proposal, which is an amendment to Section 9 to enable the IPED to identify and review legislative needs in consultation with the Secretariat and to report on such matters to the Minister. They also propose an amendment to Section 28 of the IPED Act, to distinguish between assault and torture, corruption, the inclusion of bribery by a police officer, and the inclusion of attempted murder by a police officer. Again, matters of policy falling outside the scope of the current amendment bill. A further proposal is to amend Section 29 to provide for compulsory reporting on specific types of officers by members of the police service. Then there's also a proposal to amend Section 30 to stipulate the initiation of disciplinary inquiry and recommendations from IPED and providing for the definition of initiation. Chair, all matters of policy that the committee, if they wish, could consider, but not the subject matter of the current amendment bill. Then we move on to the Africa Criminal Justice Forum. They propose an amendment to Section 7 of the IPED Act to address the lack of transparency and accountability and to compel the NPA to make decisions to prosecute or not and report thereon. Again, it's a policy matter that the committee could consider if they wish to, but it falls outside the scope of the current amendment bill. The next commentator was the Civilian Secretariat. They proposed an alternative amendment bill, well, they did at the time, and that seeks, and they sought to amend further sections of the IFPD Act. Our response at the time to that was that the PCON Police requested permission from the National Assembly to draft amendments to the IFPD Act in order to align it with the Constitutional Court order in the McBride matter. And that the Assembly granted such permission on the 24th of April 2018. The proposed bill by the Civilian Secretariat, which, Chair, I had a quick glance at the one that was provided by IFPD. I only caught sight of it on Monday, and it seems to be this exact same bill. I might be wrong. Like I said, I haven't looked at it in detail. If it is, the same comment applies. The proposed bill by the Civilian Secretariat goes broader than the Constitutional Court order, and therefore goes beyond the scope of the permission the committee requested. And then my preliminary points would apply should the committee feel the need to consider this bill. A further comment was, insofar as the Civilian Secretariat seeks to regulate the suspension and the removal of the Executive Director of IFPD through the proposed Clause 6B, a proposal in their bill, the court in the McBride matter again read in Section 17DA 3 to 7 of the SAPS Act and said that those sections should apply to the suspension and the removal of the Executive Director pending a correction to Section 66 of the IFPD Act. The court thus considered the provisions of these sections of the SAPS Act to be constitutionally compliant and sufficient to deal with the suspension and the removal of the Executive Director. We received comments from the Western Cape government. The first comment, the legal comment, was the fact that the Amendment Act, Amendment Bill, does not deal with the comments of the Constitutional Court in relation to Section 63A is of concern. It is proposed that Section 63A be qualified to properly reflect that the Executive Director is appointed in terms of the IFPD Act. The precise intersection with the laws of the public service must be considered and if applicable in any way must be adequately explained. Chair, our reading of the Constitutional Court judgment was the court found Section 63A, which deals with the Public Service Act being applicable to the Executive Director when it comes to the appointment of the Executive Director. Certain sections of the Public Service Act and the IFPD regulations which applied the disciplinary code to the removal of the Executive Director were unconstitutional insofar as they were being applied to the removal of the Executive Director. Chair, on this point, I just want to pause. A lot of submissions or commentators have referred to the High Court judgment, which the Constitutional Court had to confirm. I'd just like to draw the committee's attention to the actual judgment that the court said that it had to confirm, including paragraph 17. The court there says, rightly so, that section 63A and 66 of the IFPD Act, read with all of those provisions of the Public Service Act as well as the regulations, were unconstitutional. But it gives a qualifier. It says this is based on the fact that the impugned sections do not provide for parliamentary oversight in relation to the suspension, discipline, or removal of the Executive Director, and that therefore the Minister unilateral powers and the sole discretion to terminate the Executive Director's tenure. Now, a lot of comment that we received was about our failure to deal with the appointment provision. And I admit the bill doesn't deal with that. Our focus in the bill was to deal with the Constitutional Court order. That was the order that the Constitutional Court confirmed that dealt with the removal of the Executive Director. And in as far as it declared Section 63A unconstitutional, it declared it so when the disciplinary code that was applicable to the public service was read into 63A. The Western Cape also had proposals to deal with amending Section 4.1, 4.3.6.1 and 2.7D 28.1F and 28(3) of the IPED Act. These are policy matters that the committee could consider if they wish to, but it falls outside the bill. The next comment was received from the South African Catholic Bishops Conference. They strongly support the proposed amendment bill. They say the bill will help to ensure the executive director of IPED, and therefore to a large extent the organization as a whole, can carry out his or her duties knowingly, and only knowing that only a two-thirds majority of the National Assembly can remove him or her from office. So in general, they support the bill. We move on to CASAC. CASAC, as you heard from Mr. Naidu earlier, welcomes proposed amendments to the IPED Act, in particular the introduction of parliamentary oversight for the removal or suspension of the executive director. They also propose further amendments to the IPED Act that go broader than the Constitutional Court order in the McBride matter, and in this regard they supported the APCOF submission. Our response to the earlier points raised by IPED, by APCOP, stands, Chair, that these are matters that falls outside the current amendment bill, but could be considered if the committee wishes to, bearing in mind the pending deadline, as well as the further permission that has to be sought. The Helen Suzman Foundation and the General, they said, given the time constraints, and in order to avoid being in contempt of court, the committee must ensure compliance by enacting the bill before the 6th of September 2018. We agree with this comment, Chair. They propose the addition of the words "and as contemplated in Section 12, 13 and 14 in the definition of committee in Section 1 of the IPED Act. I think this can be tied up with a further submission, which proposes an addition to the definition of parliamentary committee in Section 1 of the IPED Act that describes the specific committee referred to in Section 6(2) of the IPED Act and Section 6A of the proposed amendment bill. This definition must make clear that the relevant parliamentary committee which is empowered to appoint the executive director in Section 6(2) is the same parliamentary committee referred to in the proposed Section 6A. I take it they refer to Clause 6A of our amendment bill. This distinction is important in order to differentiate it from the committee as contemplated in Sections 12, 11, 12, 13, and 14 of the IPED Act, which concerns the management committee. Chair, I will address this matter when we get to Clause 2 of our committee bill. The last comment on the general was that they urged the committee to continue the process of amending the IPED Act beyond the passing of the bill into law. There is room to improve the IPED Act beyond the mere technical incorporation of the SAFS Act, which effectively forms the entirety of its current bill. Should the committee decide against a broader consideration of the bill, we caution that the committee opens up to propose amendments to judicial review. Here again, we have to say that we sought the bill seeks to give effect to the Constitutional Court order in McBride, and therefore we feel that the bill fully complies with that court order. We move on to IPED, Chair. IPED said that the Constitutional Court declared Section 63A of the IPED Act in its entirety invalid and unconstitutional. They say as the result, the IPED submit that for the purpose of complying with the court's order, Section 63A of the Act must be amended also to the extent that it also provides for the appointment of the executive director subject to the laws governing the public service. In order to assist the committee in concluding this process within its set timeframes and those of the Constitutional Court, IPED has prepared a draft proposal of the bill, which in its view is consistent with the McBride judgment and will pass constitutional muster. Our response to that is that the Constitutional Court found Section 63A, which deals with the Public Service Act being applicable to the Executive Director, certain sections of the Public Service Act and the IPED regulations which apply the disciplinary code to the removal of the Executive Director, unconstitutional. but only in as far as they were being applied to the removal of the executive director. Again, to reiterate, if the committee wishes to consider further amending the bill to also deal with the appointment of the executive director, we submit that the committee would have to approach the assembly afresh to request permission to extend its original mandate beyond the one that was given to it in April of this year. Furthermore, Parliament would have to subject further substantial amendments to public participation as provided for in Section 59(1), I think, of the Constitution. Chair, that was the end of the general submissions. Now to comments that address specific clauses of the bill. Deal with clause 1 of the amendment bill. Clause 1 sought to repeal section 6(6) of the IPED Act. The Western Cape simply said that they supported that amendment. And that was the only comment directly on clause 1 of the bill. Clause 2 inserts a new section 6A into the IPED Act that now sets out the process for the removal of from office of the executive director of IPED. The Western Cape said that the proposed insertion of section 6A, which sets out the procedure to be followed when removing the executive director, is supported, subject to the drafting comments. They're asking for deletion of the article A in the term A resolution and to replace it with a direct article the, which can be found. It's a very technical amendment, Chair. In principle, we can agree with an amendment like that. That is just to reiterate which resolution that we're talking about and to make it more clear. Again, a drafting issue that they raise where they propose a deletion of the comma in line 2 of the proposed section 6AB, 6 capital A sub 5, which is again something that we can agree to. The sentence will in fact read better if we delete the comma. Further comments on clause 2 was received from the Helen Suzman Foundation. They proposed that subsection 1 of the new 6A of the bill makes reference to a committee of the National Assembly. They said that this wording is drawn from section 17D, capital D, capital A3 of the SAPS Act. They further said the use of the words a committee is ambiguous for the following reasons: that section 1 of the SAPS Act makes a reference to the standing committees of the National Assembly and the Senate responsible for safety and security, and secondly, that the term committee is defined in the IPED Act as follows: committee means the management committee established under section 11. Also, that section 6(2) of the existing IPED Act states that relevant portfolio committee must, within a period of 30 days, parliamentary working days, of the nomination in terms of subsection 1, confirm or reject such nomination. They further say that this section makes clear reference to a committee distinct from the committee management committee contemplated in the paragraph 3(1)(1) above through the use of the words relevant parliamentary. This anomaly will be addressed. So they propose that the insertion of the words relevant committee before the term committee of parliament, committee of the National Assembly in our bill. In our mind, the wording is clear. In interpretation of statutes and in drafting sense, words have to be interpreted in their context. The term committee of the National Assembly, to our mind, will not be confused with a committee as defined in the Principal Act, as the terms committee in the proposed clause is qualified, or the term committee in our proposed clause is qualified with the words of the National Assembly. So it's clear. It's a different committee that we're referring to. However, should the committee agree to a further amendment, we will support the proposal for the insertion of the words the relevant parliamentary committee, to make it clear that it's a committee of parliament being referred to. A further comment was that the Helen Suzman Foundation proposed that the wording of the clause 2 is drawn from the SAPS Act, and that the use of the word committees, and I think I addressed that already, Chair. Sorry, that was just a duplication of the same comment. CALS also commented on clause 2 of the bill. They say that section, which should be clause 6 capital A 3A of the bill, is ambiguous in that it may give rise to multiple interpretations. As such, this is not the remedy or the amendment envisaged by the Constitutional Court. They propose that the amendment should clearly state that the minister can only exercise his or her power to suspend, after consultation with the committee, any time after the start of any proceedings contemplated in section 6 capital A 1. This means that the minister's power is subject to oversight by the committee, and consequently, the amendment provisions will comply with the McBride judgment. Chair, the sections or the clauses that we propose in the amendment bill were the ones read in by the Constitutional Court in the very McBride judgment. Again, these are section 17 capital DA 3 to 7 of the SAPS Act. The court said, in the interim, these sections must apply to the removal and suspension of the minister, of the executive director of IPED. The court therefore had to consider these sections, to consider whether these sections are in fact in compliance with the Constitution. And in doing so, the court found that, well, had to have found that they are indeed constitutional in order. Otherwise, the court would not have asked, I would not have read those sections in to the IPED Act. So we feel that the clauses as we have it in the bill comply to the Constitutional Court order as it is almost verbatim the exact same clauses or provisions found in the SAPS Act, which the court has read into the IPED Act in the interim. Kels also is concerned that section 6 capital A3A provides the minister with an unduly wide discretion. Where legislation makes provision for discretionary use, they made an argument here that when it's unfettered power, it had to be curtailed with determinable principles and guidelines. And therefore, they propose that the minister's discretion be coupled with principles and or guidelines to inform the decision. And a submission was earlier made that said that the minister must suspend the executive director of IPED. The bill doesn't say the minister must suspend. The bill says a process needs to be started in the National Assembly. A committee of the National Assembly must start a process to consider the removal of the executive director of IPED. And then subclause 3 kicks in, which says the minister then has the discretion to suspend the minister to the executive director at any time after such proceedings. So already there's parliamentary oversight over that matter. Again, it needs to be reiterated that the minister cannot act arbitrarily. The minister is subject to the law, just like parliament is subject to the law. The minister is subject to the constitution and all of the laws that were mentioned by the previous commentators, the body of law of labor law that comes to play when a suspension is being considered, has to be applied by the minister. That is why Parliament has legal advice to advise Parliament about the laws applicable to instances of suspension, removal of office bearers. That's why the ministry has got legal advisors to advise the minister when certain laws are at play, when the minister has to exercise a discretion, or when a minister is obliged to make a decision, as is evident from paragraph B. But just to reiterate, this is the exact section that was copied from the Constitutional Court order. So the Constitutional Court regarded these sections to be compliant with the Constitution, sir. Chair, that in fact was the last comment on the actual bill. So I wish to end there unless there's anything further that you want me to address. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prince. We will now give an opportunity for members to interact and questions with the legal advisor. First, Honourable Kolobana, then Honourable Mbele. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I do understand that this process is overseen by various legal bodies within Parliament. But I just for my own edification, who was the person who advised the minister that it was legal to do what he did, which has now landed us in court? Who actually gave that advice to? I presume all ministers are advised by legal advisors. So one of these bodies that are here telling us what we should be doing with the bill is the same body that advised the minister that he could do that in the first place. So I'm a tad skeptical about it all.
Senator Barnard, Honourable Bailey. Thanks very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the summary briefing. I actually, at one point during the presentation, had two points in my head. I've lost one of them, but when it comes back, I'll raise it again. I think it's important to preface my comments and question with giving, with framing the understanding that the reason that the High Courts, at least to my understanding, inserted Section 17DA, subsection, whatever the rest of it is in detail, is because the courts would have been both reluctant to, and in fact does not have the power to write law. They would have been very aware of that. So they would have had to make reference to and borrow from existing statutes in order to effect an interim remedy. But that in and of itself does not mean that's what they found would be substantively sufficient. It's simply what they found available within existing statutes. So I think it's important that we not give too much weight to that. In the same way that, you know, a couple of years back, the concourse also found that in the event that Parliament does not remedy the or provide a legislative remedy for the defect in the Marriage Act, then they would simply insert, you know, certain phrasing. But we know that lawmaking is and should be a much more substantive and deeper process. So I just want to set that up as saying that the interim remedy given was not necessarily, you know, fait accompli. And so where that springboards to is a question I had raised at the very beginning of this process, Chair, when we started discussing the notion of a committee bill, which is the fact that those sections in the SAPS Acts, as they apply to the suspension and removal of the head of the DPCI, are a bit disjointed, and they do have some gaps or lacunas or whatever you want to call them. And I think this would be the time, perhaps, for Mr. Prince to give some clarity or feedback as to how those should be addressed. So we know two things, at least two things. We know that those sections, as they're currently being proposed to be the remedy for the IPID Act, is that they make provision for a committee of the National Assembly to make a finding against the ED, and then that would have to be operationalized through a resolution, and then they would be removed. But there's no clarity as to exactly how the committee would arrive at that finding, or there's no prescribed prior process for the arrival at that finding. The second thing we also know is that the sections make provision for something called proceedings for the removal of the ED. I'm going to summarize that as removal proceedings. Now, there's no particular clarity or substantive clarity as to what that means. One can assume it means it's proceedings that would arrive at the finding or decision for the removal of the ED. But if you start a process, as I've said before, whose intention, at least according to the wording, is removal, then there must be a prima facie basis for having reached that point. And so there's still this question about what's the prior trigger. Is it simply the minister submitting a complaint received and and making a request for the committee to look into it. And if that's the case, then there really is a question as to whether the mere submission of an allegation or a complaint by the minister or any other person would, by opening up then the ability for the minister to suspend while some process is other way, is not too heavy-handed, is not too blunt, given that the counterbalancing principle in all of this is ensuring and upholding the independence of the IPED. And given that we know practically recently and up to this day that there are inherent and vested interests who want to weaken, undermine and neuter the IPED. So that's my question. If we say that the proposed bill as it stands now is sufficient, what are the answers to those gaps or that disjointedness? How do we arrive at the triggering of proceedings to remove? How do we arrive at the finding of the National Assembly, of the committee, which then becomes a resolution of the National Assembly? That's the question I have for now, Chair. If the second question comes to me, I'll raise my hand again.
Mr. Prince, you can comment now, or we can, even if you want more time to ponder and respond, do that tomorrow morning. But if there's any other questions that's been raised by the legal advisor members, if there's anything, Mr. Prince.
Thank you, Chair. The issue raised by Ms. Colle Barnett, I'm afraid, is not for me to speak to. The question whether who would advise the minister that it was legal for him to do so, I'm the legal advisor to Parliament. The question might have to be directed to the legal advisor for the minister. So we do not advise the executive. That is for the legal advisors. That is attached to the ministry to decide, and to the department, Chair. Chair, the further issues that was raised by the honourable member around the findings of the National Assembly, there are various ways how matters get brought to Parliament, Chair. And one should be very careful to legislate oneself into a corner by setting particular parameters for how things must be dealt with. So I just want to caution against that. I mean, one could set the parameters to say that it must be a substantial allegation based on A, B, or C. But invariably, matters get brought to Parliament through either petitions, oversight by the committee, allegations that gets tabled before Parliament, that Parliament feels a need to investigate. The NGOs play a particular important role in this regard. There's various matters that they've raised before Parliament and that Parliament has felt a need to investigate, albeit in some cases that the court has directed us to do so. So those are the ways how the matter would come to Parliament and in effect be the trigger. There was a second aspect to the question, and I think it got to do with how Parliament or the committee would handle the proceedings or would deal with the proceedings. Again, Chair, maybe it needs further consideration, but my preliminary view on that would be that the committee, in terms of the rules, is empowered to set its own internal arrangements. And so maybe that the rule could apply and would apply to deal with how the committee will deal with the removal proceedings of the executive director of IPED. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, I think we're going to take a lunch break until 2 o'clock. We will come back. Mr. Prince, if you can be also, because I think Honourable Bailey has still got a question. Maybe not. No, we will give enough. Don't worry. We've got a lot of days. So we'll come back at 2. Then we will deal with the critical infrastructure matters. But after that, because we also need a quorum to make further decisions on the process for tomorrow, then we'll, of course, course we will have then a quorum present about 2:30, and then we'll take it further. So members, lunch until 2 o'clock. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.